On your mark, get set, save. Get to Nissan's Bottom Line Summer event and take home a winner with big model year-end offers on our award-winning lineup. Hurry, offers end soon. Shop your local Nissan store and choose Nissan.com today.
Blog Talk Radio.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. All three engines up and burning. 2, 1, 0, and liftoff.
Coach on Fire Radio.
Fire the tire.
Well, hello and welcome to the third edition of Being Brilliant Radio Show. This is really about how to ignite your life and shine. The show is about a deep and impactful look at what it takes to be brilliant. The show invites its listeners, you guys, to step into the very essence of who you are being as you show up to life, as you show up to your life, to your leadership, to your professional and personal lives. So herein is a combination of ancient wisdom teachings coupled with practical tools and essential life and leadership skills translated into actionable strategies by my interviewees. And these are people who are high performers. They're thought leaders, game changers, soul activators, pioneers, dreamers, adventurers, way seers, as well as friends and family. Those who, in my view, live brilliantly and who travel magically through life, shining their light so others may do the same. So today we have Earl G. Hall in the house. Earl has been dubbed as the scientist of happiness. Yes, you heard it here. The scientist of happiness. His purpose is to empower everyone he encounters to live an inspired life, find sustainable happiness, and embrace their higher purpose. His research focuses on many areas of human behavior and has chosen the science of happiness as a starting point to raise awareness for the animal brain that has to be mastered as a first step on the road to true happiness. Earl, welcome. It is such a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much. I feel a lot of gratitude to be with you today.
Well, likewise, the feeling is mutual. So I came across Earl not that long ago, actually, on Facebook, and everything I encountered about him, everything that he posted, was so inspirational, so insightful, that when I reached out to him to ask him to be interviewed on my show, I just felt such a synergy with him. And the moment I asked, he responded immediately and said, "Why, yes, of course." So it's a huge honor to have you here. And I'd like you to just share a little bit about your journey so far, so where you've come from and where you are right now. Just to start, give our readers just an overview of where you come from and where you are right now.
Well, I come from a very small island on the east coast of Canada. Mm-hmm. And as I like to remind myself now and then, the first time I realized that I was horrifically unhappy was the age of 4 years old.
Four?
But you can imagine, yeah. Can you imagine?
Wow. And how did you realize that?
Well, I was reminded a little later in life that I looked my mom straight in the eyes one day and I said, "Why did God drop me off here?" I was asking all of these types of questions to the beautiful people that were around me, but I couldn't get any answers. At 10 years old, I went away for my first couple of months. I took the airplane in 1977 for the first time alone at 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And then at the age of 12 years old, I announced to my family that as soon as my high school studies were over, I would be leaving forever. And that's what I did.
Goodness me. So what was your first stop? Where did you go first?
Well, I kind of like applied for anything that would get me out of where I was. It was one of those situations where you feel so uncomfortable about who you are, where you are, and why you are that I applied for everything, and when I say everything, from Coast Guard to police, well, I got accepted to the Royal Military College, so I started off my adult life in university, in a military university, to become an Army officer, of which I served a total of just about 10 years as an Army officer.
Wow. And what was your biggest takeaway? What was your biggest learning? You know, obviously there's a lot to do with leadership and, you know, all sorts that you learn as an Army officer. But what was your, now looking back on that particular time, what was your biggest takeaway?
If your I look back at that specific experience, I think that's where I learned the true nature of the word service. Because, first of all, I'll never forget the day that I signed that document saying that I was giving my life away for a flag. That was kind of a shocker when you read the disclaimer that says that you may have to give your life for the cause. But those 10 years taught me about unselfishness and basically knowing that the only limit you have is the limit you impose on yourself. One night we were going up a mountain and I fell maybe 7 or 8 times from fatigue, and I think about the 9th or 10th time I was face down in the mud and I was crying and I wanted to give up, and all of a sudden there's just strength came from somewhere, and I got back up on my legs and I kept on walking, and I graduated from that particular training I was on. And that always stuck in my mind, that everything we live is nothing more than a perception.
I'm so happy you just said that. But I want to delve further into that in a little bit later in the call. But I want to hear first a little bit more about your journey. So this is amazing. So you found the strength from somewhere. And you got up and you carried on. I know what that feels like. I've been very athletic for most of my life. And, you know, in competition, you draw from when you feel you're about to give up and your mind has already given up, but then just something within you finds that energy. And you do carry on and you realize that you can go so much further and so much faster. So what did, from finding that and digging that deep within yourself in that particular moment, what then happened?
Well, I think because of the fact that I was so unawakened, that I didn't use that at that time. I just kept on my journey. And the funny thing is that I've always been a very blessed person. The right mentors have always shown up. My career has always been one of very amazing, synchronous surprises. But the thing was, is that every time that I was having more and more and more success and my career was going so well, the void, that dark, deep, ugly hole just started to get bigger and bigger. And the day it all exploded was an inside of my values and principles: when you get married, you get married forever. And that's where it ends. That's where I came from. Well, I had to sit my 6-year-old son on the couch one Saturday afternoon with his mom, who's a great person, and I had to explain to my son that he would be having 2 houses for the rest of his life as of that day. I had had a couple of very deep down moments in my life where I had contemplated some pretty disastrous things without going into the details. But by far, that moment, seeing a part of my son's light go out, knowing that I was responsible for extinguishing a part of his light, that was the tipping point for me, because I went into a place that I didn't know existed, where it was, with all due respect, it was way worse than taking, you know, you shoot somebody in a video game, or unfortunately you run over a deer or whatever. Accidents happen. But when you look at someone within 3 feet of their face and you can see a piece of their eyes die,
wow.
That became the point where I said, I have to figure out how to create, maintain, and sustain real happiness. Because all of these diets, all of these fads, all of these 21-day things, none of them work in the long term.
No.
That was the genesis of it, really, because it destroyed a piece of my son, and it destroyed a piece of me that I vowed that day was going to be my personal life mission to get back.
Goodness me, that's incredible. And so what was the very next thing you did? Because I know there are people out there, I certainly work with people who feel a certain void like you're describing. And I know that they've ticked a lot of boxes. They've gone through school, they've gone through university, they've ticked all the boxes in terms of their career, the career that perhaps their parents expected of them or that they expected of themselves. They have the fast cars and the beach houses and all of this sort of stuff. They have all of that. And yet somehow or other, a bit like you were describing, they still feel that sense of void. Or they, even if they don't know that it's a void, they know that something's up. They know that they're not happy. What was your very next step once you realized that? You saw that look in your son's eyes. What was your next step?
Well, I'm laughing because at that point in time, I was living between Canada and Las Vegas.
Uh-huh.
I was working a lot in Macau as well. And I was having great success in my professional civilian career. So between the rock star suites in Las Vegas, the flights to China, the fun all over the world, I basically buried myself in a bottle of wine until I found what I'd like to call the sweetest, lowest, bottom of the barrel I think I've ever read in any book anywhere.
Wow.
I dug myself down so deep into a hole that for the first 2 years after I announced that to my son, I was basically trying to kill myself. And because of the fact that I have great genes, I didn't even succeed that.
Wow.
So one morning I just woke up, and for a reason that I'll never, ever be able to explain, because I have no recollection of ever buying this book, when I rolled over in bed to find my best friend, which was the Advil or the Tylenol that I used to keep handy, because I used to get up every morning at about 5 o'clock so I could be at work at 6:15, because I used to work from 6 in the morning to about 11 o'clock at night, and the rest was all personal time. I had a quantum physics book, a book of Deepak Chopra.
Oh, wow.
And I have no idea why, but I just picked up the book, and I burned through it in about a day and a half. And I kept tagging pieces of the book that didn't make sense to me.
Uh-huh.
And then I wrote the Chopra Institute. And we're going back into the This is 2005.
Okay.
So I wrote to the Chopra Institute, and I said, I have questions for Deepak Chopra. There's stuff I don't understand. They said, well, he's in New York and giving this weekend thing in a couple of weeks. Why don't you go there with your book? So I signed up for this thing, and I went down to New York, and lo and behold, in the middle of day two, I didn't have any questions anymore on the book, but I had about 6 million other questions, and that's when it all started. And I wrote down on a sheet of paper back then, Mr. Chopra, Mr. Dyer, Mr. all of the different names of the people that were out there, Robin Sharma.
Yeah.
And I spent the next 4 years of my life basically going from one person to another, to another, to another. I'd read their book, I'd ask them questions. And then probably the real point, and this is the point that I hope all of your listeners understand, because I had the expendable income to sit with these people and ask them questions. None of them gave me the answer that I needed because I wasn't asking the right question.
I love that. It's so true.
The thing that I found out 7 years into my research, and I'm talking sometimes 7-8 books a week.
Good
the thing that I found came from the craziest simple place. Happiness is nothing more than a decision. It has nothing to do with a process. It's not a diploma. It's not a result. It's not a mathematical equation. It's not that book that you have to buy or that trip, like an eat, pray, love trip that you have to do. I just woke up one morning and I said, I'm done. I am now officially declaring myself happy. And it doesn't matter what hits me from now on, my equilibrium point is going to be happiness.
I love that. Like you say, it is just a decision. That's something also I talk people through. But one thing I come across sometimes is also, even if you say it's just a decision to somebody, there's still resistance. It's like, it can't be that simple. People feel like they have to go on this big circuitous route like you did to find actually that it really is that simple.
Well, see, the thing is that until you put the work into learning what an ego is, what your animal brain is, what the basic animal reflexes that are preventing you from just giving up to your divine will instead of being in your animal free will, everybody wants to put out this big check or this, or get nailed to a cross or to get tortured just to earn happiness, when everybody forgot that when you look at a baby in a crib, if that baby is not hungry, if that baby is not insecure, if that baby has not wet its diaper, that baby is happy.
I totally agree with you. And this is, I find this so amazing. When you look at a newborn baby like you're describing, they are just this bundle of love. And yet, over the next 7 years of my life.
And that's why I started off all my research. But that your point is the point, if you want my opinion.
Yes. And just so everybody knows, Earl is actually in the middle of a PhD right now. His focus is a very scientific focus to happiness. Therefore, he's also dubbed the scientist of happiness, as I mentioned earlier. So this isn't sort of mumbo jumbo. Earl has spent a long time in the scientific field studying this, and these are his conclusions. So for any doubters out there, or anybody who's not so keen on all the mumbo jumbo spiritual stuff, this is based in science, what Earl is telling us right now, what Earl is sharing with us.
You probably brought up the cornerstone point, because science has its limitations unless deal with the polymaths. And this is where my passion is. It's to hang around with the polymaths, because if you look at just math, if you look at just physics, if you look at just chemistry, you'll never find the answer. It's too boxed up into a subset is what I'd like to call it. If you look in spirituality, there is beautiful stuff there, but it's too hard to reproduce in something that's sustainable that you can apply something like neuro-linguistical programming to. So I looked at babies, like, and I was looking at all these babies and said, they're happy. Well, in that case, we must learn to become unhappy. And as you look at what's called in psychology a learned response, which is the basic of behavioral psychology, we basically train ourselves to become unhappy.
That's just amazing.
Then when you get into the animal brain, which I like to call, which most psychologists like to call the lower brain, then I really got into the nuts and bolts of how you can learn to train and master that primitive brain to let you live in what I'd like to call real happiness, which is equilibrium, where you have sense of purpose, where you have fulfillment, where you can actually say that you're an inspired individual instead of being passionate, because passion is an animal thing where inspiration comes from your higher, what's called your cerebral frontal cortex, your higher brain. So that's where I got into saying, well, now that I'm happy, well, first of all, I was happy. And I was walking around living the most biggest extremes of polarity I've ever seen. Happy one minute, sad another minute. Happy one minute, crazy mad another minute. And I said, okay, I'm living what we call in physics, I was oscillating too high. So I wanted to bring my oscillation, or I wanted to bring the wavelengths closer to equilibrium. So I started to look at polarity, positive and negative, or you can call them anything you like. I started to look at how do I bring in polarity so that it's less extreme and that I can recuperate faster from a massive dump of cortisol in my brain. And that's really where I got into the science of this, the math, the physics, the chemistry, the psychology of it, to find out that happiness from an animalistic point of view can be boiled down to the three most basic things that people take for granted and 99% of people will never invest to learn in.
Wow, what are those?
Well, people always laugh at me until I send them off to one of the specialists that I love and respect. The first one is smiling. You're always stressed in life. You don't realize that if you smile, the muscles in your face contract. Because of that contraction, your brain thinks you're happy and dumps dumps dopamine into your brain. The dopamine cleans out the cortisol, and automatically your muscles relax because you think you're happy. So like I tell everybody, you don't have to be happy to smile. Fake it until you make it.
Yeah.
And
I actually had one of my clients
encourage
do that.
Everybody. I apologize, I cut you off.
No, carry on. I'll come back to that in a moment. You carry on.
This is the reason why I encourage everybody to do selfies on Facebook. Your whole world is nothing more than a mirror of your thoughts and your reflections. So if you spend your time doing selfies of yourself all over the place and your selfies are smiling, you end up convincing yourself through neuro-linguistical programming that you're happy.
I did
a 21-day exercise where I posted breakfast, lunch, and dinner selfies. And I was noting every single day how I felt at the end of the day when I went to bed. At about day 15, I was starting to write down things that I enjoyed about my day, things that I had gratitude for, things that made me happy in the day. By the time I got to day 18, I was actually writing that I was happy.
Isn't that amazing?
So I neuro-linguistically programmed myself to be happy by smiling. I was up to about 3 hours a day of smiling at the end.
That's amazing.
I put a mirror on my computer screen.
Yep.
I did a whole bunch of, I put my mirror of my car to my face when I was in traffic so that I could, instead of getting all mad in traffic, because you don't need your rearview mirror when you're stuck in traffic.
Yeah.
So I actually turned it towards me so that every time the cortisol started coming into the brain, and the second thing of happiness, which I could get into, is conscious breathing. Well, I'd be looking in the mirror, and as soon as I'd feel that I was stopping breathing and I wanted to rip the sheets out of my car, I would look in the mirror and I would do a smiling exercise and I would just dump out the cortisol. Because all it is animal exercises that you're doing to maintain your blissful self.
That's so true. I have a client recently, I actually had him go out and do something similar at the streets of London. Part of his homework, and his high-performance homework, was to go out and walk for 10 minutes in between. I'd have him working for 50 minutes and then taking a 10-minute break. And in the 10-minute break, he had to go outside and smile at strangers. And it was just amazing. The first day or two, he was not so keen on the idea. And then he started doing it. And then he started getting strange looks from people. And then he started doing it more and more emphatically. And then he actually got responses from people through smiles. And it reminded me of a poem that I learned when I was a kid, which starts off, you know, smiling is infectious. You catch it like the flu. When someone smiled at me today, I started smiling too. And it is just so true.
That's beautiful.
What you put out there is always, as you know, what you put out there is what you get back, 100-fold. So, like you say, focusing on the smiling, it really does begin to change your chemical makeup.
The secret of smiling is that the facial reflexes to show your teeth, which goes really back to primitive times.
Mm-hmm.
The reflex of pulling up your face to dump dopamine into your brain is very egotistical because you do not smile with your face. You smile with your eyes. And that's the reason why you have that beginning period of smiling where you feel ridiculous. It's because the only way you can smile is if you're vulnerable enough to smile with your eyes.
Yes, that's so true. And
the facial part is very egotistical. It's getting dopamine in your brain because the dopamine actually brings up your frequency and helps you to project light or frequency or vibration or an electromagnetic wave or color. It depends on your background what you want me to say, but the facial expression is all about getting your physiology ready to project the light out through your eyes.
Fantastic. I just love the way you describe that. Now, I'm just going to read out the call-in number. So if anybody has any questions for Earl, this is the number. If you're in the States, it's 646-716-7979. I'll say that again, 646-716-7979 if you have any questions for Earl, if you're in the States. If you're anywhere else in the world, there is a chat box open, so you can type in your questions, and we will get to them just after one of Earl's favorite songs. So, Earl, I asked you earlier, what was one of your most favorite inspirational, uplifting songs, and what did you say?
Well, what did I say? I'd say it's a song that saved my life at least 6 or 7 times.
Oh, my goodness.
That song has pulled me off the ledge way, way, way more than once.
Mm-hmm. And
the day I get to hug and kiss Steve Perry on the cheek from Journey, believe you me, he will remember the biggest man hug he ever got, because the song Don't Stop Believing, it is my morning wake-up call. It is my morning alarm. It's the thing goes off in my car when I start it. It's that song that has shaken up my DNA every day now for the last, I guess, 20 years.
That is just amazing. Wow. And with that, we're going to listen to it right away. So if you have any questions, hold off for just a moment. Once the song finishes, we can take the questions. And that is an amazing description of how you feel when this song goes live. So here we go, everybody. Don't stop believing. Here we go.
Keep the midnight train going.
Don't suffer living. My goodness, that certainly elevates everything. Oh, such an inspirational song. I was just sitting there going, thank you so much for sharing that. So, everybody, you can download that on iTunes, of course. Don't Stop Believing by Journey. Do you have any further comments, Earl, on that song?
What I say to people a lot is that there is one song that as soon as they hear it, their palms get sweaty and their heartbeat starts to increase. That song should be their alarm clock when they wake up in the morning, so that when they go from sleep frequency to wake frequency, they're being dragged back into consciousness by something that makes their heart beat instead of just waking up into a normal day. Everybody that I know that have done that, it's dramatically changed the way they wake up, because I can be asleep for 4 hours, have to get up for a transcontinental flight. As soon as I hear the first three bars of Don't Stop Believing, I got my two arms up in the air and I'm ready to dance on the bed.
Ah, oh, fantastic. Yes, I definitely felt that as I was listening here today. That was absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much.
Please.
So you mentioned 3 points in terms of happiness earlier. We talked about smiling. We talked about conscious breathing. What's the third one for our listeners today?
The third one is the most important, but you cannot learn it until you master smiling and you master conscious breath.
Wow. Okay.
Those two cornerstones, you have to take courses on them, you have to practice them, because the third one is, and the most important one where everybody gets bogged down, is we don't understand, because nobody teaches this in most general schooling, is that you have between 50 to 70,000 things a day that you call thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Your primitive brain sends up through the stem between 50 and 70,000 electrical impulses a day.
That's
those
incredible.
Electrical impulses have to be interpreted. So what happens is the electricity comes up, it bounces off what you have stored in your three different levels of memories. It finds something that resembles the electrical impulse and then creates a judgment, which you call a thought. So most people have between 50 to 70,000 useless brain noise thoughts per day that are doing nothing but getting them out of equilibrium, of which 75% of everything you think in a day is negative by design because of fight-flight response of trying to keep the animal alive to not get eaten by another species of animal 70 million years ago. So this brain defect today, which is inherent inside of our animal brain, makes sure that we are theoretically never, ever going to be happy. Because as these thoughts come up, because people want to call them thoughts, they're not really thoughts, but let's call them that for the fun of it.
Sure.
those 75% of those thoughts are trying to cut off your breathing supply. Because if they cut off your breathing supply, your brain can fill with cortisol, your muscles can start to fill with adrenaline, and you can start ready to get to run 400 miles an hour like Bugs Bunny to get rid of the threat.
Wow, I knew a lot of this, but I didn't know in quite so much detail. This is amazing. Thank you for sharing.
So the third thing is first of all, it is physiologically impossible to control your animal impulse electrical things that you call thoughts.
Uh-huh.
The more you compress, suppress, and depress them, the more they cause prostate cancer, breast cancer, heart attacks, overweight, anxiety diseases, depression, and I can go on forever.
Yeah.
What you have to do is welcome them in by breathing, by smiling, by keeping your brain full of dopamine, by making sure that you have a full lungs of oxygen, because of the fact that as you breathe, the dopamine is automatically expiring or evaporating, and your pineal gland keeps on vibrating. So if you're smiling, you have dopamine. If you're breathing, your pH level stays high enough to be healthy. You're keeping the cortisol out of your brain. And those thoughts that are coming up through the brain are just released, and you come out of neutrality for a much smaller window of time. Instead of being freaked out about something for 5 minutes, as it comes up, you just breathe it out. And as you breathe it out, it disappears, because all it is a waste product, electrical impulse, that is hardwired into our animal brain. That's all it is.
Gosh, that's so incredible. To hear it explained so simply, thank you so much.
Cheers. So, well, it is simple, and that's the reason why a lot of people go,
yeah,
oh, it has to be hard. You have to at least break my two legs and my two arms for me to be happy, right? I have to suffer to be happy. Well, if that's what you believe, you can waste 43 years of your life like I did.
And that's where most people are.
Yeah, that's where most people are. That's where I had my head up my behind and my head between my two legs for many, many years, because I was looking for that $500 diet or that magical pill on the top level of the pharmacy, until I figured out that if I smiled all the time, I had no cortisol. And if I went and learned to breathe, I did a keynote last week for 740 people, and I asked, has anybody here done a breathing course? And there was like 20 in the room. I was amazed that there were 20 people.
Yeah.
You have to be doing breathing courses until you master it and you have all of the muscles attuned. Because if not, out of the air you breathe, there's only 15% oxygen. So even if you're breathing properly, your lungs are only getting 15% of the total capacity in oxygen anyway.
Wow.
Yeah.
Incredible.
It's that simple, by the way.
Yeah. I love the way you described it and the simplicity of it. It's fantastic. So I have a question.
Well, my mother always told me, if you cannot explain it simply, it's because you don't understand it.
Yeah, exactly.
God bless her hands.
Exactly. God bless her. Absolutely. So I have a question from a caller who's just written in the chat box. But before I go into that, I just want you to frame or to put in a couple of words, point number three, because we've got smiling, we've got conscious breathing. And so how would you call point number three?
Number three for me is called mastery of thought, or
okay,
a lot of people like to hear me say it in a different way, which is the neutralization of animal thoughts.
Okay.
Because you cannot control this. It is as genetically hardwired as your heartbeat. So instead of trying to control and suppress, which some teachings do, which can cause sickness, the schools that I have seen that are efficient at this actually welcome it and breathe it out. And I will never pretend to be as strong and as intelligent as a woman. But having been by the side of a woman in labor and being the analytic freak that I am, watching the muscle movements, watching her diaphragm, and trying to coach her to remember how to breathe as she learned, I saw that even in extreme pain, that when you master breathing, you can actually breathe out this massive amount of pain that I never ever hope I have to experience something as painful as what I saw that morning. But those animal impulses that come up, instead of trying to control them, instead of being ashamed of them, welcome them and breathe them out and they'll go away. They do not belong to you. And that's another thing that people don't understand. Those impulses that are coming up are just what we call in the computer language, they're pinging the server. All they are is electrical impulses that are making sure that you're alive and ready for an alert that might be forthcoming.
Fantastic.
Like when you're a mom or a dad and you're going, where are you? Where are you? And you're checking on your two-year-old every 15 seconds. Because if you know that there's silence for 15 seconds, they're probably burning the house down. Well, at least mine was relatively active at that period. So the point is that those thoughts are not yours. You breathe them out, you do not judge them, and you just keep your state of equilibrium so that you can inspire, which is the word in French for breathing, it's inspirer, to be inspired, to inspire oxygen into your lungs.
Yeah.
And by doing that, you get to experience the real thoughts that come between the breaths.
Yeah. Amazing. Okay. I have one question for you here. How do you get past the fear to create that vulnerability to smile with your eyes?
That is a beautiful question, and you're asking the right person, because I failed at this. And please write down the number that I'm going to say, because if you can beat me, I want to fly wherever you are to have a coffee with you. I failed at this for 3 years because I was not worthy of smiling. I did not love myself enough to be exposed, and I did not think I deserved to be happy. I really thought I should be unhappy.
Gosh.
So the thing is that there is no magic recipe. If you live in a big city, you make yourself a budget. Or if you live in a town, you make yourself a budget. You say, well, I have a 15-minute walk from this place to that place. I am going to smile at 20 people, of which three I'm going to, and please be very careful with the words I'm going to use because they're different than what we're used to.
Sure.
You're not going to look in their eyes. You're going to let them look in your eyes, because that's the other thing we don't get. You do not look somebody in the eyes when you smile. Because you can only smile with your eyes if you have an open heart, you're letting them look at your eyes. In other words, you're taking off your veil, it's called. So, fix yourself a budget of 20 people. You're going to be scared to death. I did it not too long ago to somebody that I didn't want to. There was a guy in an airport, and I'm on a guy exercise right now, and I was in a United States airport, and I saw him coming, and I said, I have to smile at this person. So I started my breathing exercises, and when I looked him straight in the eyes, and I smiled. And I thought I was going to throw up from stress. There is no magical recipe. You're going to be scared to death. But you have to fix yourself a budget of 20. You're going to fail 17 times, if you're me. You might only fail 10 times. But I failed a lot at this in the beginning because I really didn't love myself. I really wasn't worthy, and I didn't deserve to be happy. I was punishing myself because that's what I felt I deserve. But you have to fix yourself a very nuts and bolts budget. Say, I'm going to smile at 20 people, and of those 20 people, I'm going to look at least one person out of the 20, pick the person that looks the least threatening, a 90-year-old little old lady that needs to be smiled at. I used to do it with 2-year-old kids a lot because a 2-year-old kid can read you like a book.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd be sitting at a fast food restaurant somewhere, and there'd be a family, a table or two over, and I'd look at the little newborn kid that's about 6 months old, sometimes a year, sometimes 2 years old, and I would just smile my eyes out until I recognized that I was an idiot, and then I'd look away. But there is no recipe. You're going to be scared to death until you practice it enough that you don't care anymore. So my favorite definition of courage is that courage is the intersection of fear and choice.
I love that.
And you're going to fail a lot at this in the beginning, and celebrate the failures, because failure can be beautiful when you recognize that every single failure is a step forward towards success.
Yeah.
100% agree. That's my take on how to smile, because it still scares the hell out of me sometimes when I pick somebody in an airport and I say, okay, I have to smile at this person because it's some that I don't feel worthy of. I feel less or they're more beautiful than I am. I feel self-conscious. And I still live that every single day, so it's never going to go away.
And yet it does get easier. As we were all taught as kids, practice makes perfect. It does get easier.
You're 100% right. It does get easier because we start to recognize that out of the failures, we're starting to have patterns that are successful. And when we start to repeat the successful patterns, we increase our success rate. We start to feel good about ourselves. We start to feel worthy. And there's a magic thing happens one day where you recognize that you're starting to love yourself. And then the sun starts to shine.
Certainly does. I remember when that started to happen for me, when I suddenly started realizing that. And I'd like to ask you that same question. I'm just going to give the number out one more time. If anybody has any questions in our last few minutes, the number to call is 646-716-7979. And there is a chat box open if anybody wants to chat and write a message in. So when was that moment for you when you realized that you're starting to love yourself? Or more than starting to, remembering to, because as a little-born baby, you knew how to love yourself.
Christmas Day 3 years ago, woke up with a horrific hangover, was lying in bed, and my girlfriend was pretty pissed off at me because, I'm sorry for that word on radio, she was very mad. I was taking it for granted that she was very disappointed at me because I had finished the 24th of December out partying with my cousins and friends instead of doing what I should have done and showed respect and showed gratitude for the amazing person that she is in my life and spend quality time with her. And I woke up that morning and three things happened profusely, and they will happen to every one of us at some point in time. First of all, I started to cry, and I was bawling my eyes out, and I didn't know why.
Okay.
Second of all, I started to feel gratitude for the awareness of the void that I had created in my life and all of the things that I was doing that were not me, but they were facades of me hiding from me. And the third thing that happened was I said, well, I think it's now time that I love myself. And it came out just like that. I said, well, I don't think I have an excuse anymore. I have to love myself. And I got out of bed that morning, took my celebratory Tylenols for the very last time, looked in the mirror and I said, okay, as of today, I love myself. And from now on, I'm not going to accept that I don't love myself anymore. It doesn't matter what happens, I'm going to love myself from here on in. I sat down with my girlfriend, explained to her where I was in my head. I apologized to her, gave gratitude to my mom and my son. Never touched a drink since, and every single day since then, I always make sure when I'm brushing my teeth, because if you've noticed, brushing your teeth is a rendezvous with a mirror.
Yes, it certainly is.
So I always make sure that the rendezvous point includes a cynical, sarcastic Irish smile that I have that I inherited from my mom. And it includes me looking at myself in the mirror until I can see my own eyes, which usually takes 15 seconds because I like to hide from myself. And once I can see my own eyes, I say, I love you. And it's usually very uncomfortable, and I choked on my toothbrush because of this. And I keep on brushing my teeth, and I carry on with my day. But at least twice a day, I say to myself, I love you in the mirror.
It's
just my story. That's all it is.
Yeah, and I'm sure with all that you've shared so far, there will be many people on the call who will be able to take this, your three steps, and even if it was just that, because this is something I get a lot of my clients to do as well, is looking in the mirror when you brush your teeth in the morning and the evening. Like you say, it is a rendezvous with the mirror. And I remember when I first started doing this as well, I couldn't even look in the mirror, let alone look in the mirror and tell myself I love myself. I just felt so alien and so wrong and so out of place. And how could I possibly? And there's so much wrong with me. But no, you know, the more I did it, the easier it got and the better it felt.
Well, if you look in the mirror and you do not smile and you do not breathe, your brain fills with cortisol and you will literally rip yourself to shreds with judgment, insults, and profanity.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, this is literally about time we've got. We've only got 2 minutes left. So I feel like I could talk to you for hours, though.
Thank you so much.
Follow you. Thank you. So that people can follow you or find you on social media. I know you're very active on Facebook. Where should people go to find you?
Really, the place to find me is Facebook itself.
Okay.
I'm very loyal and dedicated to those people who have been with me since the beginning and all through my journey. When I was drunk on stage in the Philippines, singing Journey, if you can imagine it, back in the old days. Oh, my God. Anyway, the thing is that I'm a regular guy. I'm a regular tech. I come from a very small village in Newfoundland, Canada. My mother has trained me to be very grounded. If you need me, just ask me for something. That is why, now that I know why I was born, if you need something, my job is to serve you. So just write me a note. If you need a reference, if you need me to repeat something, if you need a website, if you need a recipe, just give me a holler on Facebook. That's where I live. Because of the fact that I spend three quarters of my year in an airplane all over the world, Facebook for me has become, outside of my son, my sister, and my mom, and the lady in my life, Facebook has become my family. So if you want to become part of my family, it'd be my pleasure to serve.
Wonderful. And what would be the link? Facebook.com/ Call Earl.
Call Earl. And my mom wanted to make sure I was very unique, so there's an E at the end of Earl.
Facebook.com/
Call Earl in one word.
Call HALLEARLE. There we go.
Yep.
Facebook.com/ HALLEARLE. Well, thank you so very much. We've got about 10 seconds left. So thank you. I look forward to engaging with you further and to taking this somewhere else, perhaps on stage one day. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you so much. See you soon. Bye.
Cheers.
I can do anything. I can reach any goal today. I can do what I want. I can be what I want to be.
Coach on Fire Radio.
That isn't just the sound of the all-new 2016 Mercedes-Benz GLC being put through its paces. It's the sound of innovation. The innovation behind one of the most advanced SUVs on the road today. With multiple driving modes, a suite of intelligent drive systems, and a technology-filled cabin that sets new standards in modern luxury. This is what innovation sounds like. Now, discover what it feels like in a 2016 Mercedes-Benz GLC.
Some equipment described is optional.